Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 206, featuring Matt Fairclough. And I will get to Matt in a second, who is an awesome person. But this is officially, I guess, our very first episode of 2019. The last one came out on the last day of 2018. But this is in 2019, and I wish everyone a happy new year. I'm very excited about it. I have a question for you guys. I would love to know, what were some of your favorite episodes of 2018? And if you'd like to, you know, love to know what your thoughts are on that, you can go ahead and just go to our website, chaoscoop.com, and go to the CG Garage section, and you can comment on there. Or you can go to our Facebook page, which is CG Garage Podcast, facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, and let us know there. Or go on Twitter. Our Twitter account is CG_labs. Or you can just email us, labs@chaosgroup.com. That's another easy way to do it. But I would love to know what some of your favorite episodes were of 2018, because I'm trying to sort of be a little nostalgic for 2018 and think about all the amazing ones that I've done back then, and there was several. So I'd be curious to hear what your thoughts are on that. The only other thing I'm going to say is my new podcast, which is not taking away from this podcast, but it's a separate podcast I'm doing called Martini Giant, will be coming out with new episodes starting January 9th. So very, very soon. We're going to be releasing them every 2 weeks. So I'm very excited about that. And so keep an eye out on that. We're also on Facebook, so look up Martini Giant podcast on Facebook if you want to check that out. We're also just martinigiant.com if you want to go there. But we'd love to see what you guys think. The episode that's going to come out is about The Godfather Part 1 and Part 2. It's a lot of fun, and we're going to keep going. I think we're going to release those every 2 weeks. So if you enjoy this podcast, you may actually enjoy the Martini Giant podcasts as well. And so back to Matt. Matt Fairclough is a founder of a company called PlanetSide. And PlanetSide makes a piece of software that some of you may have heard of called Terrigen. And so he's the guy behind Terrigen. And Matt is an absolutely wonderful person. Very, 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 very smart, as you will quickly gather when you hear the podcast. This podcast gets very technical and very geeky, which I love. But Matt's also a very shy person. It took him a lot of convincing to get him to go on a podcast. So we tried to relax and chill out. We went to lunch and we had a couple of beers and decided to have a cocktail while we were recording. But it was a lot of fun to sort of hang out and chill out with Matt. And you can see what kind of an amazing brain he has. He's loves the subject of rendering. Loves the subject of rendering. And so, of course, I do too. It was a really great podcast to have with him. I really like Matt. Really like him a lot. He's a wonderful person. And he's also, not only is he an incredible developer, but he's also an artist. He's worked in the industry as an artist. I was working with him at Digital Domain. So really, really amazing guy. And it was a pleasure to have him on. So with all that being said, please enjoy this incredible podcast with Matt Fairclough of PlanetSide. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Yeah, I had to think about it to decide whether it was actually like an old-fashioned, but I think it is.
It is. I think the only thing that's missing is if we had, you know, the giant ice cubes.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not much of a whiskey drinker. I don't usually, but I do occasionally have an old fashioned, and it's
pretty good.
When I'm sick of the beer and I'm out, I'm like, yeah, let's give me an old fashioned.
The place that I got old fashions was in Stuttgart. some reason at the FMX conference at the Maritime Hotel lobby bar, which is where a lot of the speakers stay, they make a really good old fashioned there.
Nice.
And we ordered a whole bunch of them. It was really delicious. So anyway.
So is it old fashioned or old fashioned? Because my linguistic brain tells me it should be old fashioned.
I believe it's old fashioned.
Yeah, but no one says it like that.
No, but no one says Pontiac either. They say Pontiac.
Oh, that's an American thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's the same. But isn't it the same idea? I
mean, yeah, exactly.
It's like old fashioned. Duh.
Yeah.
Right?
I guess.
Yeah. But yeah, anyway, at the Maritime Hotel, they made these delicious old fashions, and we used to have them. So to me, weirdly having an old fashioned reminds me of Stuttgart, Germany.
Interesting. It's good how that works, right?
Yeah. 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 It's cool. I'm glad I was able to try this out. But we've had you and I have known each other for, my God, now how long has it been?
Well, I
guess Stealth was the first thing we worked on together, but we knew each other before that.
Yeah, I just realized the AC went out and suddenly I can hear myself way too. Anyway, yeah. But yeah, I think it was, so I first came to DD in 2000.
In 2000?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know if we met exactly then.
I came in 2002.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I was on Day After Tomorrow. Now, were we using Terrigen on Day After Tomorrow?
Day After Tomorrow. Yes. Only briefly. So.
Which sequence?
Do you remember the opening sequence with the mountains in the background? So you're flying across the ice.
Oh, the ice. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So the mountains in the background, they were Terrigen.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah. That was interesting.
So I think that might have been the first use of... I think that was the first use of Terrigen in a movie.
Really?
I think so. It may have been that or Star Trek Nemesis. But I think maybe Star Trek Nemesis was after that.
Star Trek Nemesis was before that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, because Star Trek, I remember coming in and they were talking about having worked on Star Trek Nemesis. So it was definitely before that, which is interesting. Okay. But that actually brings up the whole idea of what we were talking about earlier, that you were always interested in computer graphics, right?
So I think I was interested in lighting in a sort of very general sense before I was even into computer graphics. I was always fascinated with the way light would like shine through a glass. I remember as a kid, I would sort of go outside and have the sunlight shining through and see how it scattered, and it was always fascinating. And then my dad kind of introduced me into computer programming. So we had a VIC 20 and a Commodore 64.
Uh-huh.
And so yeah, started with the VIC 20 actually. I was just programming really simple stuff in BASIC.
Okay.
And then my friend had an Amiga. So I had to get an Amiga, but I was fascinated with the Amiga because of the gaming and the graphics and the music. But I never really had this idea that I could program the thing because I thought, wait, that's going to be way too complicated. So,
what was the thing about it? Like, so you didn't think you could program into the VIC 20?
What? No. So programming the VIC 20 was really simple because I was programming BASIC,
right.
And I didn't really know how you could program this really amazing graphics and music that was in the Amiga. So I just got the Amiga. I got it as a Christmas present.
Okay.
And I just wanted to play games on it. And then
what were your favorite games to play on your Amiga or your account?
I don't even remember anymore.
Yeah.
Because very shortly after that, I started working with Deluxe Paint.
Oh, right away.
So then I started painting stuff and I got fascinated with graphics and then also music programs.
Right.
And
you started programming music and doing graphic stuff?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what year was this approximately? Think about that.
91 maybe?
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay. 91. Yeah. All right. Okay. So I remember playing with 64, Commodore 64 in the, I want to say 80, 687.
So yeah, playing. my dad had a Commodore 64. I think he had two of them actually, because he had his own business. He was a joiner, like a carpenter.
Ah, okay.
So he would make, design and make and fit windows and doors.
Oh.
So he was self-employed doing that.
So was he using the computers to figure out joining and all that other stuff?
Well, originally he was using the Commodore 64 for accounting. And
right.
Then,
yeah.
And then,
which makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Here's the crazy part. And then he bought a PC. But right. Then when he bought the PC, he started programming it, and he programmed his own system for laying out and calculating the dimensions of windows and doors. So one of the big problems at the time was calculating the dimensions of a bay window.
Oh, right.
So he was saying that all the other guys in town they would lay it out physically on the ground, and they would move things around and measure it out. He's like, you know, I think I can write a program to do this.
Nice.
So, but he wrote it in BASIC. I think it was GW BASIC.
Right.
So I think he probably set the idea in my mind that you can invent your own stuff, and you can, you know, gave me that DIY attitude.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So you were fascinated with light, et cetera. But what led you more specifically into computer graphics?
There was a program called Vista Pro.
I think I've heard of it. Explain it, though.
So that was by today's standards, it's super simple. But it was a height field renderer. It was a landscape generator. It had like a built-in fractal generator.
Uh-huh.
But you could also import DEMs, digital elevation models.
Right, yep.
So you could render real places and places on Mars as well. So they had a whole bunch of DEMs of Mars built into the thing. And I think I was just really fascinated with that. And I don't think I wasn't really that interested in the outdoors until I started using Vista Pro.
Okay.
So computer graphics kind of gave me an appreciation for
Nature
in a really weird
that's
way.
A weird,
and the like, two things yeah. kind of fed back on each other for a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that when you see computer graphics, right, that you suddenly, like, I actually think that computer graphics gave me an interest in cameras.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
It's,
yeah.
it's kind of exactly. The same idea, right?
And I had a similar thing. I started dabbling with cameras for a while, but I realized it wasn't really my thing.
Right.
But I can totally see how that works, yeah.
Yeah, because suddenly, like, oh, now I get why it's important to know about cameras. Or, like, suddenly, like, you need to, if you get interested in Vista or Terrigen, for that matter,
yeah.
Now you're like, I want to go outside and see nature because that's my best reference to what my program needs
exactly.
to do, right?
And then you start, everything you see outside, you start to see it through that lens of, wait, how can I recreate this?
Right.
And I think at that point you start to become a slave to that. And I think
you think
sort
so?
Of, yeah, because I sometimes think, well, what would my life be if I didn't think of things that way?
Well, that's
I mean, it's
how long
not necessarily a slave,
this?
But you, it definitely sends you on a path.
But you've been doing this for a long time, right? How long, when did you start Terrigen?
So going back to when I was programming the Amiga.
Uh-huh.
Like, so I used to, you know, I used to spend a lot of time on the computer. I wasn't really very social as a kid.
Sure.
So
none of us were.
Yeah, yeah. And so I used to, there were three things that I used to keep coming back to. Graphics in a general sense, like I would, you know, paint stuff or I was doing a little bit of 3D rendering. I would try and model spaceships and then music, you know, experimenting with making music, because I also play the piano, or I used to.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of let that skill slip a little bit. But then programming. And then I was always programming these little experiments and little game projects. And I realized eventually that I could combine programming with graphics, and I was always programming little games that They sort of fulfilled me artistically in terms of something. I don't know what it was, but it was definitely a graphical focus to that.
So there was graphics specifically.
I was always interested in programming graphics. And the more I learned about how how you code something, how you code graphics on a computer, the more I was fascinated with learning more about it.
So definitely not accounting software.
No, exactly.
So completely the opposite. Yeah. Yeah, I get it. I mean, I remember specifically when a friend of mine had a computer and like, you know, very early days, I'm talking like 1984, you know, it had the first PC, whatever, you know, and they were like, how am I going to make an image? Like, oh, well, that's, you got to make a color for every pixel. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lot of information you got to put in there.
Yep.
But that was fascinating to me, you know, trying to figure out how to do that.
I think a lot of things are only interesting if they seem a little bit difficult.
Uh-huh.
And then I've always been drawn to things that other people said, well, wait, that's too difficult. I don't think you could do that.
Right.
But if I'm already working on the problem, it kind of spurs me to try and do it.
Sure. Yeah. I don't blame you. I think everyone's like that. I think everyone's like that, even artistically speaking, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you this though. There's something a little bit contrarian for me about this. Is I actually love to find difficult problems that I suddenly have simple solutions to.
Yes, exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But you want? I mean, I know you're. You're a mathematician, right?
Yeah, the math guy. Yeah.
You want to find those elegant solutions.
Yes. Elegant solutions are prettier than non-elegant solutions.
Yeah.
Right? I actually, it was interesting because I was a math and an art major in college, right? So a double major. And so I forgot, that was some art project I had to do. And it was about something about beauty that was the subject or something. And I think it was for printmaking. So you could do lithography or different types of, you know, art forms, et cetera. And I decided to be, you know, slightly an asshole, I'll admit. But I had worked out, I had just been learning Mathematica on the Next Machines, right? And I was working on some complex topology geometry. This was my first realm in the computer graphics was topology and representing, or 3D graphics, representing topology and computer graphics. And I developed an equation to represent a Klein bottle, right? But it was really complicated because I made basically three equations, one that went for this way, one that went this way, and another one that went that way, right? And it was a really, because that's the traditional way of representing a Klein bottle, right? So it's there's a tube that goes one way, there's a tube that expands, and then there's another tube that folds back into the original tube. And it was kind of an annoying way to represent it. But I did that. And it was a long equation in Mathematica to do that. But then I came up with another equation, which was basically just a torus that flips itself inside out, which is basically the same thing as a Klein bottle.
Yeah, because, I mean, usually with a complex problem, you have to, if you don't see the overall solution, you got to decompose it.
Right.
So that's what you're doing.
And I did the first way I decomposed it, and it was a long equation. And the second one is like, well, wait a minute. It's just a torus that flips itself inside out. So I made that equation, but then I developed a four-dimensional perspective system to be able to change the perspective. And it basically, I was able to represent a Klein bottle that was not just a flipped torus, but actually something that looked right. Anyway, I put it up there and I had like a really long equation and a really short equation. And I was like, that was my representation of beauty, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then
the interesting thing is once you get to that point, maybe that is a more general solution that you can use to represent more than just that one example.
Right. But to me, it was pretty, right? Yeah. To me, and not only that, but the beauty was exciting.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
You know what I mean? Don't you get excited when you're like, oh my God, this is so much simpler. And then sometimes you're like, that's beautiful. And then sometimes you just look over your shoulder and go, why didn't anyone else think of this?
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that part. I mean, isn't that part of your job that like gets you excited?
Well, it used to. Big part of my job now is also keeping the business running. So I don't get as much time to actually focus on those things as I used to. But I think that's just part of I mean, that's just part of changing what your role is in any industry, I think.
Okay. So let's talk about that for a while, because you've been thinking about this specific problem of terrain.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah. Maybe too long. I'm probably obsessed with it. It's interesting because, originally I was driven by certain ideas about the kind of landscapes I wanted to create with CG.
Sure.
And there weren't really other tools around to do that. So I felt like I was building something that was needed. And we're definitely in we're definitely in a different landscape now with,
yes,
with modern renderers can, and I don't even intend to use it, but there are, modern renderers can handle so much complexity, so much.
Sure.
But there's still that balance you have to find between how much do you model, how much is baked into the polygons or the displacement map or whatever it is, and how much do you compute on the fly?
Or generate.
Yes.
As in Terra generate.
Yeah. Sometimes I look back at that name and I think, could I have come up with something a little bit better? But
I like it.
Yeah.
No, TerraGen is a good name. Yeah. I mean, I think if you were to do it today, it would actually, you would find some silly fancy name and stuff. But TerraGen speaks specifically of its origins and of what it was like back in those days to do that. Because you were mentioning the fact specifically at DD, right? Looking at doing very complex computer graphics with a lot of quote unquote geometry or generated geometry.
Yep.
Using only 512 megs of memory that you had available on your computer.
Right? Yeah, in the early 2000s, I think the desktop I had was, I mean, between 500 megs and maybe one gig. Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, we had to render.
Which, by the way, is 8 times less than your current iPhone.
Yeah. How much of that is actually RAM, and how much
RAM,
is it?
RAM.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, RAM on my phone, I have a Pixel 2, so that's a year-old phone, is 4 gigs. So that means that you had 8 times less memory than my phone to do TerraGen.
And actually, sometimes I like to think, well, what's it going to seem like in the future? Like, let's say we fast forward 20 years' time and people are going to be laughing at it. So it's always going to be that way. So
sure.
So back then, to render a landscape that you had to travel across with the camera and get full 2K resolution for film, you could do it. There were ways of doing it, but it was just so difficult.
Right.
And, you know, this would be a very expensive show to be able to do something like that.
Right.
But I was already fascinated with this problem anyway, so.
But you were mentioning at lunch, and we should mention this specifically. You were fascinated with computer graphics. You never, when you started it, that was what your interest was. So you fell into feature film or visual effects world just because it seemed like a really good use case for computer graphics, right?
I think when this first kind of came to me, I mean, when the possibility of working in film was presented to me, I mean, I'd never even considered it. I just thought, okay, I'm building this tool for users. Mm-hmm. I want to make this cool graphics program.
Who wants to use it? Oh, it turns out movies want to use
it. Yeah. and also, so at the time, Kelly Port.
Kelly,
I think it may have been Kelly Port who contacted me. It's interesting. So there's Chris Blythe.
Yes.
So I was in England, so I was still at university at the time.
Okay.
And by this point, people were recognizing TerraGen and people were downloading it. And Chris Blythe was working at a games company in the UK called Team 17.
Okay.
And I'd been playing games made by Team 17 for many, many years.
Right.
So he called me and he said, hey, why don't you come over to Wakefield and get on a train, come to Wakefield and interview with the team. And like, wow, this is really cool. So I think the head of Team 17 at the time was a guy called Marcus Dyson.
Okay.
And he was also the editor of a magazine that I'd been reading for many, many years, Amiga Format.
So right there, it sounds
so
cool.
Suddenly I was meeting people who I knew the names of these people, and I thought, mm-hmm. this is the coolest thing. And then they'd made Worms, which was a really, really big hit. So I don't know if you remember that game.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah. And then it was ported to
every... It was an Amiga game, right?
It was an Amiga game, and then it was ported to every single platform
okay.
over the years. And it's
that's why probably
a huge franchise.
Yep.
But then... So they said, yeah, would you want to work for us and make tools? And I was kind of already at that point attached to the idea of continuing with Terrigen. So
you wanted to make your own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't really feel like you wanted to work for another company and do their
own business. Not at that point. And then Chris Blythe came over here to Digital Domain.
Yep.
And again, he was telling people about what Terrigen was and who I was, and that led to a job offer. And I thought, you know, this is too big an opportunity to pass up. So
right. Well, Chris is an amazing guy, very entertaining.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Chris is amazing.
Yeah, funny. It's got a booming Scottish laugh. I knew him from DDE, obviously. But I also have a huge debt to him for the V-Ray IRL video. He actually had a nice role to do with that. So I just want to thank him for that. but that's cool. So that led you to DD. So at that point, you just move to Los Angeles?
Yeah. So
we're talking 2000 at this point.
So
right?
when yeah, this was in 2000.
Right.
It wasn't so much that I didn't want to work in the movies. Like when this opportunity came to me, I realized, yes, this is exactly what I want to do. This is how I want to apply Terrigen.
Yep.
I just never thought that it just wasn't on my radar.
Right.
And I was never really a huge film fan, but certain things from sci-fi always inspired me. Like that, like Alien, those establishing shots of the alien landscape
yep.
in the original Alien. Yeah, things like that. And I was always fascinated with spaceships, especially atmospheric entry. Like certain specific things that always kind of gave me a target of something I wanted to aim for. I wanted to create software that could recreate or improve upon those kinds of shots.
I know what you mean. I'll be honest with you. I'm actually not dissimilar. I got into computer graphics, or I got into doing imagery. I think I got more interested in seeing things that weren't possible.
Yeah. And that's right? Why sci-fi is really interesting, because it shows you things that
yes.
we imagine that we should be able to do in the future, but we really want to get there now, but we haven't got there yet.
Yeah. And honestly, but it's not just sci-fi. Like, I actually think architecture is the same thing, right? Like, you imagine something that doesn't exist
yet. Yeah, yeah.
You know, you imagine something that's going to do that, but you're actually looking at it in like, well, imagine if that happens, right? Or imagine if this happens. And so you can think about it in concept art, et cetera. But I have always been interested in environments, you know, and I think sounds like you were too. I was interested in manufactured environments mm-hmm. based on architecture. You're interested in natural environments, right? It's not dissimilar. It's really cool that you can create and design your own natural environments, mm-hmm. you know, not many, you know, you created a tool specifically that I think a lot of architects would be envious of.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so.
You know what I mean? Because that is a way to generate mountains. yeah. Who can do that? But it's really an interesting idea, but there is a lot of other problems that you had to solve along this line, right? So it's like, you figured out like, how do I see a landscape, and you solved it with the tools based on the physical limitations that the computers had at that time. You mentioned the 512,
yeah.
you know, megs of RAM. Like, I'm going to create the most realistic, most detailed physical landscape I can represent with 512 megs of RAM.
Yeah. Right? And you know, what I was doing wasn't exactly new, because you have people like mm-hmm. Ken Musgrave, you know, he's been working on that problem for many, many years.
Sure.
Fully procedural terrains. And then there are plenty of other people who are doing similar things.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's cool to do that. Right. So, you were able to generate stuff. That's the thing. Terrigen is not just about modeling mountains.
No, no, because
it's about
that was
it's
all a, that was so.
There's my a procedural part to this.
My interest was always it was kind of evenly split between create and modeling mountains. You know, whether I'm modeling them procedurally or some other way.
Sure.
But also, so originally I was looking at, so again going back to Vista.
Okay.
They almost had the terrain problem solved in a very simplistic way. I don't know whether you would use it for film quality stuff, but their skies didn't look very good. And I was always very, I always wanted to improve upon that.
Sure.
Sorry, I'm stumbling my words.
Yeah.
Creating or simulating the way light scatters through the atmosphere.
Right.
I think maybe there was one paper back in the 90s, which kind of got there, but I hadn't read that. I hadn't read that until much later.
Right.
So I was working on my own solution. So I think many of the sky shaders that exist in other packages right now, I think they're based on that same paper or something like that. But I was working on my own ideas for that. So I didn't know that anyone else was able to create a CG sky that would look realistic.
Right.
But I wanted to solve that problem.
Sure. But that is a difficult problem that, you know, because honestly speaking, I think in the computer graphics world, people weren't thinking of something that you would look at that's maybe 100 miles away.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why. Because I mean, it's all about the image, right?
Right.
I was fascinated with getting the computer to construct this image. I mean, maybe obsessively, like... There are certain things where sometimes you just want to paint something,
right.
And I'm thinking, yeah, but I could do that procedurally, and then you kind of check yourself and you go, yeah, but you know, we actually need to get this job finished, so painting it is the better way to do it.
But there is a distance thing, right? Like there's something like atmosphere. Let's just talk about the atmosphere issue, right? Atmosphere is actually a very challenging thing because what you're doing with a sky shader, or a, you know, aerial perspective, or whatever you're doing in that area, you have to consider very, 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 very sparse atoms across 1,000 miles or more, right? Yeah. And therefore, that look of how things, light scatters and changes color over that distance, that's an interesting, that is a problem that is very challenging. We're talking about the smallest particles in nature over thousands of miles of distance in a very sparse area.
But no one tries to render that. So what you do is you say, well, this is what I want to, this is the color of the pixel that I want. Okay. What's different from my current model? What's different between my current model and what I want to see?
Okay.
And then you see a problem. You're like, well, what natural phenomenon would explain the difference between what I'm seeing and what my current model is?
Yeah.
And you look at it and you figure it out. And of course, you know, we all know that to accumulate the opacity over a long distance, the most important factor is it's going to be proportional to the distance between, you know, the length of the ray.
Right.
And then so that's your first approximation.
Okay.
But then you want to do that differently for the red, green, and blue channels. And that's where the blue sky comes from, is the fact that the atmosphere scatters blue light more strongly than red light.
Uh-huh.
But when we think of scattering, we tend to think of, oh, so it means it goes in a different direction. But it's also in scattering. So the reason the blue sky is blue is because light can be scattered towards your eye from any direction. It doesn't matter where the sun is. All the photons come from the sun. They can be behind you. They can be ahead of you. Blue light can be scattered in any direction. So
blue light scatters more, like has a wider scatter than
air molecules. Due to Rayleigh scattering, So the Rayleigh model says that. It depends on the wavelength.
Yeah. Let's keep going. I think this is awesome. Keep going.
Let's see. So, it, it, I always struggle with this because I always think, well, how do I explain it? And it depends on the audience, right?
Okay.
So blue light has a different wavelength from red light. So depending on the wavelength, yep, of the shorter the wavelength, mm-hmm, I'm gonna trip over my thoughts here because it also depends on the size of the particle as well.
Okay.
But essentially what happens is blue light can get scattered by the atmosphere in any direction. Red light requires a lot more atmosphere before it gets a chance to scatter towards you. So if you have a very dense atmosphere, eventually the sky can turn white. Although it doesn't actually turn white because then you've got it gets more complicated than that.
Okay.
But essentially the idea
is that thin atmosphere is going to scatter blue faster than anything else.
A very thin atmosphere will be able to scatter some blue light towards you. So even a very thin atmosphere will be able to create a blue sky.
Right. And then slightly thicker atmosphere would create a green sky.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting because I was running into this problem where as you make the atmosphere thicker, you start to get a greenish sky, and you don't really see that in nature. Part of the problem is ozone changes things. The addition of the ozone layer, the addition of the ozone layer uh-huh, above the Earth kind of adds a bit of extra blue to things, which is interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah. But that's not something that I tried to model until about 2 years ago. But I was seeing other people who were modeling it in their atmosphere models and getting good results.
Interesting. But okay, so we've been I'm going to bring this up because this has come up. And this is a hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
Mars.
Yeah, I love Mars.
Yeah, I know you do. So I know you're going to totally clam onto this. But we've been seeing some new recent pictures of Mars based on the InSight stuff that landed. I mean, based on when we recorded this podcast, it'll be a couple days ago. Actually, yeah, it landed yesterday. Was it yesterday? No, 2 days ago.
I think it landed on Monday.
Monday, right. So we're on Friday. So anyway, that sky's not blue.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many factors in this that I've been fascinated with the subject for a long time.
Sure.
And I honestly don't know. I just don't know. I don't know how blue the sky is on Mars. And I think my own guess is what we usually see is something, I think it's probably similar to what a dusty desert, let's say you go out to a really dry desert and it's a very dusty atmosphere.
Okay.
Imagine you've took all of the oxygen and nitrogen out of the atmosphere and you were just left with the dust. You'd end up with something that's mostly just this orangey thing. And as the sun shines through it, some of the sunlight is turned more orange to a certain extent.
Okay.
But one of the big problems you see in a lot of Mars movies is they like to make the sunlight really orange.
Right.
And I don't think that's really true.
Right.
The sunlight itself that comes through is probably fairly whitish. But the sky, because the sky is orange due to all the dust in the sky, the shadows become orange or yellowy. So the shadows become...
So it's the... what's the word that we the perturbance in the air, right?
Yeah, and
it's the dust.
I don't remember the exact definition of what was it? I know the parameter you're talking about in that sky model. And I got to admit, I never fully understood what the purpose of that parameter was because I didn't read that.
Well, I could tell you when I saw it.
Okay.
I saw it because you and I live in Southern California. Mm-hmm. When we saw all the damn fires out there, mm-hmm, and you saw all the smoke and the sky was not blue.
Yeah.
It was.
What's most fascinating about
it?
It
was actually not, but it wasn't red either. It was gray, rusty, maybe.
And it also depends on which direction you're looking at. So when you look towards the sun, it's more red.
Mm-hmm.
This comes back to smoke. You know, when you see smoke, you often think of smoke as being blue.
Do you? I don't.
Okay, so
I think of it more. It depends on the smoke, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no. So mostly, it depends on the direction you're looking.
Okay.
if you have smoke over a black background, mm-hmm. it's going to look bluish, especially if the sun is behind you.
Right. Okay.
So
yes.
So that when the smoke is front
yes.
lit,
yep.
Are you seeing it fully lit? It's going to be bluish.
Right.
But then when the sun filters through that smoke, the sun becomes reddish.
Right.
And it's actually the same. That's actually Rayleigh scattering in the same way that the atmosphere has the same
effect. But it's always these strange things, right? So like when you try to mimic the subsurface scattering of milk.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
I think you mentioned this in a previous podcast.
But go ahead. Tell me. Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason it looks so something you mentioned, you said you have to carefully balance the idea that the light filtering through it is kind of reddish. I forget how you
put it. The subsurface of milk is actually fairly brown, and the single scatter and the specular is fairly blue, and they cancel each other out to make it look white.
Right. And this is where I think there might be something slightly non-optimal with the way we currently build our subsurface
right.
shaders, is you define these terms separately and then you have to get the hues right.
Right.
Which is usually okay if you're doing something like skin.
Sure.
But if you're trying to simulate milk, what's the one thing we know about milk? It's white. So you know that the sum of those two terms still has to add up to white.
Yes.
Which makes me think maybe we shouldn't be modeling it in terms of these two separate things, but it should be parameter should be it's white. And the other parameter should be how much does the scattering vary
across
the wavelength?
All right. So let's go back to this. Are you more so obviously based on the way you were talking about atmosphere, you're thinking about wavelengths.
Spectral rendering. I do think about wavelengths, but I don't use them.
Okay.
I still use RGB rendering.
Right. Do you think there's what is your thoughts about spectral rendering?
I think there are a lot of cases where if you used it, you would get a different result. I don't know whether you need that different result.
Okay.
But yeah, it all comes down to when you multiply colors together. So whenever you bounce between two surfaces,
yep.
the you're multiplying the reflectance or the diffuse reflectance of each of those. Of those surfaces.
Yeah.
So depending on how you model it, it completely changes the result of the multiple bounces.
Right.
So the question is that important to you for your particular application?
I don't know.
And yeah, a lot of people don't.
I don't know. I mean, it's like, does it really matter? Like, you know, because the guy who I learned about the milk subsurface stuff is from Graham Feith, who's a Uber nerd, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you know Graham, right?
Mm-hmm.
ICT and Google and stuff now, so he's doing. But he was literally modeling milk that way, and I'm like, because most people would just say it's white, you know, and they make everything white, and it'll probably look the same. But he's like, no.
If you're looking at your render of some milk, and you're looking at it, and you're thinking it doesn't look like milk, it looks like some kind of chalky powder,
right?
Paint. Yeah, or paint. Yeah, you might say, well, why does it look like that? And can I make it better? And then it's going to be really important.
Yes. No, that's true. Absolutely. All right. Well, this is awesome. We went on several tangents here. But I love the idea that you've thought about how light scatters through atmospheres, what it does through this stuff. I don't know how we're going to figure out how to render Mars. But we're already halfway there with Terrigen.
I tell you what, I don't think the problem is in the technology. I think we can easily render Mars with the technology we have. I think it's going to be, what do people want Mars to look like?
Well, sure. But we deal with that problem with Earth too.
Yeah.
You know, Instagram filters can massively affect the way that your photographs uh-huh. look. And so unless you're like accept quote unquote raw photograph, it's not going to make a difference.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. All right. So, but now I know you and I have been talking about rendering, through lunch, which is an awesome thing, but I want to still go back to your 512
All right, okay.
Meg image that you figured out, like, how am I going to get the most detail of this? And what I want to, I'm actually going to tell you where I want to start and where I want to go. And I want you to tell me the whole story between okay? So I want to start with, like, how am I going to render the most detail out of this using the technology I had back in 2000, right? And I want to go to all the way to how, why now the difference between ray tracing and rasterization and that whole narrative.
Oh, wow. Okay. Because I don't even
remember. You can make that journey.
I don't know how we did that, but.
But you can start with that. So think it, start with, like, you figured out, like, okay, I'll start it this way. You figured out how to do displacement at super high detail in a rasterized manner, and you figured out that's actually super efficient, right?
Yeah. And so this was based on, so I like I said, I was watching VistaPro.
Yes.
So originally when I was coming up with these ideas, I wasn't aware of RenderMan at that point. I mean, mm-hmm. I may have heard of it, but I wasn't really on my radar. Mm-hmm. But VistaPro gave me the idea that you can take a polygon and recursively subdivide it to create as much detail as you want.
Sure.
And when you're rasterizing, you don't have to remember anything. You just, I mean, it obviously depends how the rasterizer is written, but essentially I'm like, okay, well, this polygon's too big. Let's make it smaller. And then when I get down to a small enough polygon, I'm going to put it onto the screen and then forget about it.
Right. Which is the raise.
Wait. Yes, and that's basically the RAYES algorithm.
R-E-Y-E-S.
Yes.
Which people should realize, render everything you ever saw.
Yeah. But at the time, what drove me to continue with this was, at the time, RenderMan had this idea of displacement bounds.
Yes.
And I thought, well, why should I have to? So,
wait, explain displacement bounds.
I don't know if it's relevant anymore. Because I'm sure RenderMan doesn't work that way anymore.
But people need to go through this history. This is an important part. So early 2000s, actually, RenderMan had a system called RAYES that allowed you to displace or break down a picture that pretty much down to one pixel equals one polygon.
Yeah.
And then a shading rate.
Shading rate, yes.
So a shading rate of one means one pixel equals one polygon, and would break that down. It would displace it. It would put textures on it. It would do everything into that level, and it was actually very efficient.
Yeah.
But it was all rasterized, right? And you could displace a lot, because pretty much a 2K image was pretty much that's how many polygons you had in your image, and you were done, right?
Exactly. So you can get as much detail as you want, because if you need more detail, you just take something and instead of rasterizing it, you say, oh, wait, let's split it into two or four or whatever it is, smaller pieces, and then see if those are small enough. And if they're not small enough, I don't think that's exactly how RenderMan worked, but that's the way I work.
But you didn't, basically, you only broke down your geometry to what you saw on the screen.
Yeah, so the crucial advantage is you can have a very low res polygon representation of the thing you want to render.
Yeah.
And if the camera gets very close, the closer it gets, the more you subdivide that into smaller and smaller pieces.
Yep.
So if you, where this is really useful is if you have a displacement shader.
Right.
And then if your displacement shader, the more detail you need, the more detail you can get. And as long as your shader will provide an interesting shape that exists at a small scale.
Right.
Which is great for terrain. That's perfect for terrain.
Right.
The problem that RenderMan had at the time, which I'm sure is not an issue anymore, is in order for it to optimize, in order for the renderer to know which pieces were visible within a particular bucket mm-hmm. of the image, you had to tell it what the maximum amount of displacement that could possibly occur would be.
Right.
Which meant, and so that was a value in world space.
Right.
So this kind of limited the amount that you could really subdivide something. Like, you wouldn't be able to take a triangle that was the size of a mountain, and then put the camera right next to it, right next to a tiny little pebble.
Right.
Because this mountain, the shape of this mountain could be displaced by hundreds of meters. So you'd have to have a very large displacement bound of 100 meters. Now, if you got very close to the mountain, if you got like a few centimeters away from the surface, mm-hmm. and you were telling the renderer, there's a displacement bound of 100 meters, which means I don't know what other stuff is going to be visible near this pixel. Mm-hmm. So the renderer has to compute all of this extra, it has to tessellate all of this extra stuff.
Yeah, makes sense.
That's why displacement bound was very critical to optimizing your render times.
Right. Because otherwise you say, just displace everything.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but with Terragen, what I wanted to do was, I wanted to start with a very low res model, something that could represent an entire planet. Mm-hmm. But I still wanted to move the camera very close to the surface.
Down to the pebble. You want to start with planet, go to pebble.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a problem.
So, but it isn't really, because...
Right.
So if you think of two sets of data, if you think of the initial geometry, mm-hmm. I'm not really sure how to explain. It's so long since I've thought about this problem, actually. It's really old stuff. The way RenderMan approached it was you have your initial geometry and then you have a displacement bound and then you can further subdivide it.
Yes, 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 yes.
But in a real scenario, if I were to subdivide this mountain so that each polygon is only, let's say I were to subdivide it so that it looks okay on the screen, but I just need a bit more extra detail.
Yep.
By that point, I would know that my displacement bound might only need to be a few centimeters.
Okay.
But, so why don't I progressively refine the planet? And as I'm refining it, I can reduce my displacement bound. That's the crucial idea. And that was the main difference.
So you were basically like changing your displacement bounds as you're subdividing.
Yes. So I was using relative displacement bounds. So it was the displacement bound was relative to the longest edge of a triangle or something like that.
Right.
That's the general idea.
Which also means that the user never had to worry about displacement bounds.
They did sometimes. So you'd have a default displacement bound and then sometimes you'd have a really spiky terrain where it wasn't enough.
Right.
And you would need to increase that.
But nonetheless.
It's more so the displacement bound then becomes about how rough the terrain is, mm-hmm. not how big the terrain is.
Right. Okay.
But I think most renderers that do displacement these days, I think they
just brute force.
I think they apply the same idea. They must do.
Okay.
But I don't know about that. I don't know. That's the way Terragen works anyway.
Okay. Well, but you were at that time you were using rasterization to do this, right?
Yeah.
That was a way to do it. You would only mm-hmm. displace on what you saw on the screen, right?
Yes. But so I tried using, then I tried working with shadow maps. So earlier than this, I had an earlier version of Terragen, mm-hmm. the original kind of like, just experiment which became popular.
Sure.
And that was just a basic height field renderer. So everything was really simple. I worked in a height field. I calculated where my shadows were cast. Everything was super simple.
Right.
The kind of thing that a game engine now can render in real time.
right. That was a long time ago, dude.
Yeah.
It's 2018. Can you believe it?
Yeah, I don't know.
18 years ago when you started at DD.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about that.
Okay, go ahead.
Wait, where was I at?
So height field map.
Oh, no. So I kind of... So when I was working on this new problem of relative displacement bounds,
yep.
This was going beyond that because now I had to solve all of these problems that other renderers have solved. Like, so initially I was trying shadow maps, mm-hmm. realized, multi-resolution shadow maps. And because I wanted to render whole planets, but be able to zoom down from space.
Yeah.
And I realized, I got to ray trace this stuff. I need to ray trace my shadows.
Yeah.
So I had to get ray tracing working, and this is really scary. Mm-hmm. Because I had this nice engine that was able to render all of this nice displacement really efficiently. But
you couldn't get efficient shadows out of it.
And I had to get this working with a ray tracer. And so I, you know, I cheated. I mean, after porting all of this, porting chunks of code over into a separate ray tracing engine, you kind of have to maintain the rasterizer and the ray tracer as two separate sub engines.
Okay.
And you're trying to share the code between the two as much as possible.
So you basically had two render engines. You had a rasterizer and a ray tracer.
Yes.
And you had to get them to work together and composite an image simultaneously.
You've got to make sure that they both render approximately the same, but shadows don't. I mean, it's
specifically shadows. I know that problem.
So you
back in the days in the you know, 90s and 2000s, shadow maps, like, I wanted them to die like a horrible death, right? Ray trace shadows were so much better.
Yeah.
Sharp or even, you know, area shadows were so much better.
Had to pay for them with render time.
Right. But shadow maps, like, the fact that you even have to pre-compute your shadows is an annoying factor. So, yeah.
That whole thing is something I still struggle with today, because I've got certain things in my volumetric renderer where it's not fast enough to brute force it.
Oh, so you have to do a pre-compute.
I'm not saying it's not possible to brute force it fast, but in my current code,
we still pre-pass. Like our light caches, you know, our GI is pre-passed, right?
Yeah.
That's why it's really good, because just give me 10 seconds mm-hmm. or maybe a minute, and then it'll be really good. I promise you. You know what I mean?
But, and there are so many advantages to that, but it's still kind of painful knowing that you have to
do that.
You have to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for this particular problem, it's huge change in scales. There were so many reasons. I thought I could figure out some multi-resolution shadow map, so I'm really bad at reading papers.
Okay. Most artists are, and I think that you are at your heart a little bit of an artist.
I probably am. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would.
But you still read it. Hmm? You still read a paper.
I read some. I've read some papers over the time. So I knew I needed to ray trace it.
Right.
And I thought, if I can solve this problem, because at DD at the time, I wasn't seeing any other renderer that could really handle this level of complexity with ray trace displacements. I knew that RenderMan could handle it with rasterization and shadow maps, but so that was a breakthrough moment when I was able to get my ray tracer to cast shadows into this dynamically tessellated displaced surface.
But how did you manage that based on the limitations? Because obviously ray tracing at that time was heavy to do, right?
Yeah, and the amount of code that array intersection routine had to run through,
right?
It was ridiculous. So the only way to get this to be anywhere near efficient is to just change the tessellation level of the geometry that casts the shadow.
Oh, right.
So I have something called a ray detail multiplier, which is
sounds fancy.
So many of my users hate this setting and like, why is the surface underneath the water kind of blocky? And like, oh, you need to change the ray detail multiplier. Anyway, so ray detail multiplier stands for multiplier of the detail that is seen by the ray tracer.
Okay.
So the ray tracer can work with a less heavily tessellated version of the geometry. And our default is 0.25, which means that the length of the triangles are four times as long as what the rasterizer sees.
So your rasterized render has four times more detail than your ray tracing renderer.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you know, increasingly people are just putting that up to one, and, you know, computers are getting faster. It's okay to do that now.
Which means might as well just ray trace the whole thing.
Well, it's basically, we're almost getting to that point with Terrigen where we just ray trace everything. But rasterization is still useful because that first ray intersection still takes some time.
Right.
at least for a, I mean, it depends. If you were to pre-calculate everything, if you got a piece of geometry that already exists in memory,
right,
then all of these problems go away. But because we're still subdividing on the fly,
okay,
there's any way that we can save time really helps. So we still rasterize the initial geometry by default. There are options to fully ray trace everything, but
right.
So by default, what we're doing is rasterizing everything, and then you can get the same visual fidelity as if it was a ray traced image by using a deferred shading.
Okay.
Like most game engines do these days.
Okay.
So now rasterization is kind of like an optimization for the first ray intersection.
Okay. And
I mean, eventually we're just going to say, let's just ray trace everything. And that is the way it's going to go. So there's going to be a significant period of time, quite a few years, I think, where, especially in game engines, they're still going to use rasterization to optimize their primary pass. I think so. I mean, secondary rays, you kind of have to ray trace them.
Right.
Otherwise, well, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
You know better than I do about why we should ray trace everything.
Yeah, no, but I want you to say it. You know, it's like, because there is a, you can only go so far, but I work for Chaos Group, and ray tracing is like, no, we should ray trace everything, right? But you gave me a very compelling argument about why rasterization still has some life for that primary ray.
Yeah, and I just want to make it clear to anyone who's listening, I'm not like some major proponent of rasterization, because I've realized that there's kind of like there are two curves. So the more pixels you have to ray trace,
right,
the more expensive ray tracing becomes. And then let's say you have a scene that has 10,000 polygons in the scene. Mm-hmm. And you have an 8K image to render. Mm-hmm. Rasterization is going to be quicker because you loop over 10,000 polygons instead of looping over 64 million pixels or something like that.
Okay.
So whether you should ray trace or rasterize basically comes down to, in a simplified way, if there are more polygons than pixels, you should probably ray trace, because you loop over fewer pixels.
Right.
But if there are more pixels than polygons, then you should probably rasterize. And then there's going to be some constant multiplier in that equation.
More pixels than polygons.
Yeah, and that's like I don't know whether there's a factor of 100 or 10 or something
right
in there, but generally speaking, the more pixels you have, the more likely it is that you should rasterize.
And the more pixels you have, the more likely you should ray trace.
No, the more pixels you have, the more...
Oh, pixels. Sorry. Yes. The more polygons you have, the more you should ray trace.
The more likely it is that it's going to be more efficient. And of course, it's going to depend on exactly how the renderer works and the models and the shaders, right, and everything. But that's where it comes down to. So this is why I think that, especially in real-time rendering, ray tracing... rasterization will always be there in some form. Sorry, not always, but it will be there in some form for at least another 10, maybe 15 years. And the reason I say that is because our resolution requirements keep going up. VR.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm there.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't got anywhere near as close as we need to in terms of the resolution of VR.
Not even close.
VR needs to get so much more high res.
Yeah, low polygon, low quality, I'm saying, quote unquote, rendering is becoming popular again based on the VR demands.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Did you realize, Matt, that we've already gone an hour?
I hadn't thought about it, but it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds about right. Can I just sit here and drink this and not speak?
Well, okay. Well,
I'm just joking.
what do you want me to talk about? Because you and I have had this fascinating conversation about rendering. You tell me, it's like, you know what? I really want to talk about rendering. And you have.
Yeah. And we could just talk about rendering forever. But
right.
I think what's interesting to me at the moment is I realized that I've been so focused on rendering for so long that I haven't focused enough on making it easy for the artist to create something.
Okay.
And
Terry, do you think that's the problem right now? Do you think this is the world of computer graphics?
I don't know if it's a problem across the board. Mm-hmm. I think it might be a problem for the future of my product. So this proceduralism is great. You know, we can get all this detail we want, but you have to think in a certain way. And
By think, do you mean you have to also educate any new users?
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean? Because that's the thing that I've always thought about. It's like, oh, you know, the people that are using V-Ray now were probably like 5 when I started using V-Ray. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well, I guess we're just old.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
And so I assume that they knew what I knew back 15 years ago, whatever it was, but they don't. And so to them, they just assumed that the world existed when Terrigen or V-Ray was around, right? So we're not the new products anymore. We can't think of ourselves as that way.
No. And
so what are you going to do to make the world simpler for your users?
Well, so I've always had this problem where I've been working on a show and, you know, the director says, hey, I want a mountain there. And, you know, I know it's going to happen. I know it's something you deal with, but you're kind of taking a chunk of stuff and you're moving it around and it never really looks exactly like what you want it to look like. And then I look at concept art and there's something really, really attractive about that, about the way you can just paint whatever you want. But it takes a huge level of skill to create a realistic looking image, or a concept artist, or then you might take that to matte painting. To make a matte painting look realistic it just blows my mind how they do it. But what's really attractive to me is, why can't we just sketch everything? Why can't we sketch an image out? And it doesn't have to be based on the final shot. It could be, you look at something like ZBrush. ZBrush is all sculpt-based.
Sculpt-based, yeah.
But I want to create something where you can sketch the shot that you imagine in your mind and have the 3D geometry emerge from that. So, and the thing about that is you can allow the artist to inject some of their own personality. The more the artist can draw, and I can't draw. I'm useless. That's why I code, right? Because I want the computer to do the work for me. But I can draw. I can draw a little bit. I can say, hey, I want a mountain there, and I want a river coming through here. I want it to look like this based on my current camera.
But okay, all right. But isn't this basically what people have been promising us in the machine learning world?
Yeah.
Right? But now, okay, so do you want the machine? Okay, all right, let's take a step back, right? Where do you think it needs to be for, like, Terrigen? Let's say Terrigen evolves to a new evolution of what it's going to become, right? Is Terrigen going to say, all right, I am going to, there's two ways you can go, right? You can say, I'm going to draw some rivers, I'm going to draw some mountains, here's a lake, here's some trees, clack, 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 clack. And then Terrigen interprets all that information and does one of two things. One, it generates a bunch of geometry and atmosphere and 3D geometry, and then actually renders physically accurate stuff, or two, completely ignores all that and generates it all based on learned machine learning of terrain images that it has acquired from millions of data.
I think you could go in that direction. I think
you could actually not render.
Yeah, well,
or not ray trace or whatever, right?
But you can insert the AI at different parts of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to use AI to generate the final image, although that's one way of doing it. you could say, well, just use AI to figure out what the geometry and the displacement is and all of that stuff.
Right.
And then use physically based techniques to render the final image.
Right.
So, you know, there are so many different ways you could apply that. Now, I'm not an expert in machine learning, so I'm...
No. But so, we all need to be aware of this.
Yeah,
this is an important part of the... I mean, computer graphics, the machine learning, and that... It was interesting. I had a conversation with a guy, and his interpretation of, you know, the machine learning thing where you feed a computer a bunch of, you know, impressionist paintings, and then suddenly it turns out an impressionist paintings based on your description of whatever, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like, oh, well, take this drawing and make it an impressionist painting. I mean, there's actually apps on your phone that will do that based on that specific example. And then his thing is like, well, that's stupid. It's basically just a party trick, right?
Yeah.
And that's fine. But that is the first thing that people wanted. They could show the public a concrete example of machine learning, right? Machine learning is easy to understand. Like, I give you a bunch of impressionist paintings. Now give me an impressionist painting.
Yes.
Right?
But actually, yeah, that's a really good way of explaining or showing what. So you can either look at that and say, okay, that's great, but that's all it can do. Or you can look at that and go, oh, wait, if it can do that.
Maybe it then, can do something else.
So, you know, something, one of my first thoughts when I saw that a few years ago was, well, we could use that to generate displacement maps or textures. And I mean,
explain that.
Well,
so how would you use machine learning to generate displacement matter textures?
So again, I'm going to bring it back to landscapes.
Yeah, of course.
Terrains. So
yeah, no.
I'm thinking if I say
it's well, familiar territory.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the way. Yeah. Anyway, so if I know I want a particular feature here and a particular feature here, and then I feed it a bunch of elevation maps. Like the entire Earth is a source of data, and then you throw in Mars as well, and you
sure.
and then you say, okay, well, based on the existence of this and this, some kind of deep learning thing or whatever it is, can something figure out what patterns exist in nature that would be consistent with the requirement that we have a mountain here and we have like a plateau here and then it drops off here. And then you kind of take those patterns from
right.
all that data that already exists. I don't see why that should be. I mean, that should be possible. Someone's got to do that. But I don't think that's what I'm going to do because I don't know enough about it.
I think it's important for people to know that you are a developer that has actually worked in production. You've created a program that is, people going to go out there and buy Terrigen, et cetera, right? But you've actually sat there at Digital Domain and worked on movies or done other things and worked with directors that say, I want a mountain here and I want a mountain there. So you understand that. And that's a big deal, which by the way, like it or not, makes you an artist.
I have no problem with that.
And being an artist and a developer is actually kind of an awesome thing because you think about a lot of stuff. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that developers, I know Vlado goes out in nature and thinks about things, right? As do you. But I think that you look at that and you look at it at a point and go, I remember that meeting I had with that director, or I remember this concept art that I tried to do something of. So you're always thinking about how that's going to turn into a final image.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is something that a lot of developers don't have, and that's kind of beautiful. And the fact that you're doing it specifically on environments is a powerful thing. There are several things I've always been fascinated about Terrigen. Obviously, back in the early days, to me, it was like, how do you get so much freaking detail out of this stuff, right? Because that was impossible. That you were doing the impossible in terms of detail, right? Nowadays, in the ZBrush days and the high RAM days, et cetera, you can, I know from the digital human work I'm doing, it's like, I got 16K displacement maps. I'm not even worried about that stuff. So that's gone away in terms of that problem. But you thought about it back in those days and you were dealing with it in those days. But what you also did is you thought about that atmosphere. You thought about the clouds. You thought about the way light scattered through fine particles. And that's fascinating to me. What can you tell me about clouds and atmosphere, besides the fact that we talked about the blue sky stuff? What's the most interesting thing about atmosphere to you?
Well, something that often comes up is how do you composite an atmosphere over something in the background?
Over an existing plate.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, because you kind of have to, it's not just a straight addition, because although, let's say you've got a blue sky and it tints the mountains blue in the distance.
Yep.
That doesn't just mean that you add more blue to the distance, because let's say you view some distant snowy peaks.
All right, just because I know where you're going, which is great. Great, it's really good. But I want to make sure that people are following along. So imagine you have a picture of something that involves a background, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a very boring field of some kind with some sky, and there's an actor in there, and you want to put a more interesting background in there.
Okay, that's not exactly what I was thinking, but so I was thinking about.
Give me a better example.
Well, I mean, it's maybe it's not really a great thing to talk about, but
no.
Let's say you have the Death Star.
Okay.
Outside of the atmosphere.
Outside. Okay.
Yeah, it's outside the atmosphere, but you got a shot from inside the atmosphere.
Oh, right. So you got a Death Star that you're seeing through atmosphere.
Yes.
Yes.
Or a big moon.
Or a big moon.
So let's say someone's painted that moon and they just want to put the Terrigen atmosphere over the top.
Right.
So you know how the moon turns yellow and red as it goes towards the horizon?
Yes, beautiful.
You can think of that as a compositing operation.
Yes.
Where the red, green, and blue channels, you have more opacity in the blue channel, which... Wait a minute.
Going back to your blue example, is that why?
Which blue example?
The blue thing about the atmosphere. The thinner the atmosphere, the more blue it is, right? Is that specifically why when the sun goes down over the horizon, it turns redder because the atmosphere is thicker at the horizon?
Exactly the same reason. Yes. So it's all.
I just want to make sure that people follow along.
Yeah.
That.
So it's exactly the same thing. So the reason the sun goes red is because the atmosphere...
There's more particles to go through.
Yes. So the lower it gets to the horizon, the longer the path of atmosphere that the ray travels through.
Right.
But the reason it turns red and not just dark gray is because that the light along that path is... It's going to scatter more of the blue light and leave more of the red light in place. So more of the red light continues to get to your eye unaffected.
Oh. So the blue light scatters more. The red light is more directional.
So there is there's a percentage of light that always gets to your eye directly.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking at the moon or the sun on the horizon,
mm-hmm.
the sun that you can see is direct light.
Right.
That no molecule has interfered with that ray.
Right.
And then all of the sky that you see around it is a ray that has that's not the right way to talk. There are two separate things.
Okay.
The sky around you is light that may have hit the surface of the Earth 100 miles away from you, but somewhere in the atmosphere it kind of hit a molecule and bent towards you.
Right.
Yeah.
basically like skin.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're all so similar. And the same with milk. It's exactly the same thing.
Right. Yeah.
It's all related.
All right.
Anyway, we talked about atmosphere way too much. But
No. Yeah. Because atmosphere, I think, is so important. I mean, atmosphere is something that you have thought about for way longer than most people.
Yeah. Hey, I gotta keep myself employed, right?
No. And that I think is an education that we all need, right? We can't just say, yeah, I'm just gonna put some quote unquote atmosphere in there and it works. But like knowing what it's like makes sense, right? So if you wanna understand and make a really beautiful sky, it's important to know a little bit of the science behind that sky. Yeah. Just like you know, I can't just say, oh, just pick up a DSLR camera and take some pictures. There's only so much the camera can do. Mm-hmm. You have to know a little bit about how a camera works before you can make it beautiful, right? So, absolutely. But yeah, atmosphere is big. What about clouds? Let's talk about clouds.
I think so you're seeing a lot of interesting research right now with multiple scattering through clouds, and people it's getting to that point where multiple renderers and multiple VFX facilities
right
now know how to render realistic scattering in clouds and make it look really good.
Okay.
So you've got that one problem, and then you've got the other problem, which is actually simulating the shapes of the clouds themselves. And you've got, fluid dynamics. I mean, fluid dynamics is probably the right way to do it.
Sure.
I have some cheats in Terrigen where I I basically just use fractals. I've used fractals for a long time, and I kind of bend them to try and make them look like fluid dynamics.
Okay.
But I think it comes back to that principle of trying to make it easy for the user. You just want to say, hey, I just want a bunch of clouds here and here and here. And sure. I don't want to spend a lot of time simulating that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're now starting to think of Terrigen as an asset generator. So we're gonna make it possible to export VDBs.
Right.
So you could render them in. But it's interesting because a lot of people are asking us to export our cloud volumes to VDB, but then there are other people who are saying we really love the scattering that you have in your clouds. And how do we get our data, our volumes into Terrigen? So there are...
Right. So they actually want to create their volumes from simulations.
Yes.
But render them through Terrigen.
Yes.
So like bring in a VDB from Houdini and render it in Terrigen.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
And...
Well, I want to render a Terrigen cloud in V-Ray, as you know.
Yeah. We'll make that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. But either way, I think it's awesome that you create things and you render things, right? And you've thought about those two different problems. I think it's really cool. Now, okay. Since you started this whole idea of rendering and looking at terrain and looking at the Earth and Mars, et cetera, how has that changed your perception of the planet or any other planet for that matter?
I don't know whether it's the thing I will talk about is it gives me an appreciation for how it doesn't. So if you want to simulate something procedurally, mm-hmm. you want to come up with some kind of model that represents a version of reality. The universe is, if you look at the space, like in mathematical terms, if you look at the space of possibilities, let's say we had some piece of code where you manipulated it and you tried to simulate many different patterns. For example, so mountains on the Earth or on Mars, you know, you can have all kinds of different geological features and you can have all kinds of different drainage patterns and things that grow on the planet change the way the system evolves.
Mm-hmm.
But most things we see in nature, they still look plausible. And you know how when we're trying to build something in CG, it's so easy to make it look fake.
Actually, I look at the sky sometimes and I said, if that's a real sky, but I would reject that.
Yeah.
It happens often. Right.
Yeah. That's also a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, oh, that sky looks so good. It looks, I would say that looks fake, you know?
Yeah. That's definitely a problem. You kind of have to rein it back and actually just do something that people are going to expect.
Yeah.
But until you get that model until you get that way of thinking or the right tools in place where you can consistently create something that looks realistic.
Yep.
Anytime you try and deviate from that and try and create something different, like fractals, let's say the Mandelbrot or the Mandel bulb.
Mm-hmm.
You would look, they look great, but if you saw, you wouldn't think that that would exist in nature.
Right.
So there's this whole space of possible things we can create that just don't look realistic. The actual number of things which we can create which do look realistic is so small, such a small subset of, right. of the things we can do. And yet nature continually shows us things that are surprising. So the space of possibilities is infinite.
Right.
The universe is almost infinite, but it's a smaller infinity than the number of things we could create ourselves.
Right.
And we're constantly fighting between, well, wait, have we just created something that's in the larger infinity, or have we created something that's part of the infinity that's actually possible?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
That's why it's so hard to do procedural anything, because you can come up with some function that creates a crazy pattern, and then if it doesn't look realistic, you're going to reject it.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, when I was in architecture school, there was a you know, that stupid book. I'm not going to call it stupid, but the book called Chaos, right? And it was about, you know, chaos theory, and everyone was obsessed about chaos theory back in 1993, right? And it was like, oh, everything comes out of chaos and the butterfly effect, mm-hmm. and all of those ideas. And so fractals were the canon for that, you know, like that. Fractals, like, oh, everything comes from fractals, right? And so Mandelbrot sets and fractals and Perlin noise and all that stuff, right? I met Ken Perlin, by the way. He's a really nice guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Have you met him before?
I don't think I met Ken.
Oh, my God. He is, okay. You know, when we were talking about the old fashions in Stuttgart, mm-hmm. I had him with Ken Perlin.
Nice.
And yeah, he is a, he is an entertaining person, and you would get along with Ken,
yeah,
really
sure
well. But there is something about noise patterns and everything else that we've taken for granted, right? So I've known certain visual effects supervisors who have actually outright rejected noise fractals because they feel that it looks CG.
Yeah, and if you see something like that and you say, oh, I've seen that pattern before, you're going to reject it. But then
right.
you're also thinking, you've also got to be aware of the fact that even if you don't see it as CG, you're thinking, well, are other people around me going to see this as CG?
Right.
I have a limited experience, but yeah. So I can see how you would be drawn to the idea of just, let's just eliminate procedural and noise patterns completely.
And just have everything hand-drawn.
Yeah.
There were people that would hand, like on this specific guy, he was like, hand draw everything. I was like, oh, you know, there's more efficient ways to do this.
Yeah, but if you get there, if you get the results, I think.
Sure, sure.
Because I think people are going to appreciate, it's the lesser of two evils, right?
Appreciate it. If you see something. It's like, it doesn't matter, right? I mean, actually, in some cases, you can get a massive amount of beautiful detail out of fractals, right? That you're not going to be able to achieve. You know, look at the Mandelbrot set. It goes, like, it keeps going and going and going and going.
That is fascinating in the sense that it really does change every way you look at it.
Right.
And a lot of fractals don't, because then, yeah. And sometimes I've in the past I've looked at that and thought, well, some of those patterns in certain places, the Mandelbrot set, they look like erosion channels. I'm wondering if we could use that as a very fast way to approximate certain kinds of landforms. Because it's so quick to compute.
I mean,
it's just like four lines of instructions or something like that, two maybe. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember trying to do one on the PC back in 88.
Yeah.
It was very hard. It wasn't much code, but it was hard to compute.
Yeah.
In 88.
Yeah, because I forget exactly how it works, but there was an issue where the further you zoom in, you have to do more iterations to get the same detail. So there is that. On the other hand, that's only like a linear increase in the number of iterations to get like an exponential increase in detail or something like that.
Right.
Still very powerful.
So how much geology have you studied since you've been?
None, really.
Really?
Nope.
Really? But how, I mean, you're doing a really amazing job considering the geology stuff that you're looking at. I mean, like the geometry that's coming out of TerraGen is amazing.
So in some cases, there are other tools like World Machine and also Gaia, which is a newer tool that's on the market now. So a lot of the really interesting things come from simulating erosion. We do have tools in TerraGen to simulate erosion, but there are some other tools that are a little bit more advanced. And then there's also a plugin for TerraGen by a guy called Daniil Kemperov, which is really great. But anyway, so I've mostly focused on not trying to simulate geology directly, because I know there are these other tools that are more focused on that.
Right,
but what I'm fascinated with now is the idea of combining hand-drawn or hand-designed outcomes with a more physically based process. So erosion is much more physically based than many of the things we usually do in CG.
We use
noises.
Yeah, erosion is basically really slow fluid dynamics.
Yeah. But it's not. But it's actually not that slow. Well, I guess it depends how quick fluid dynamics are now.
No. I mean, in terms of nature.
Oh, yes.
Yes. You know, millions of years versus, seconds.
But actually what's interesting is you can also have some landforms are created from a very fast, very rapid flow. What's the terminology I'm looking for? You can have like a flash flood or a mega flood that can gouge out huge canyons. And then you can actually think of it in terms of a real-time fluid simulation.
Right.
And you could simulate those things. And then there are those slower processes which just create these cones of material.
Right, the mesas and the stuff like
and
that.
And that's actually a key idea if you want to get a close approximation to a real terrain very quickly, is think of it as a bunch of cones.
Bunch of cones?
Yeah.
Explain.
So you know how a talus slope on the side, like the side, you've got a mesa, you've got this big chunk of rock which hasn't eroded yet, and you get these triangular or cone-shaped fans at the base of the mountain.
Yeah.
And many mountains kind of, as a first approximation, they look like a cone.
Right.
Or a cone extruded, you take the point of the cone, the apex of the cone, you extend it out and that's your mountain ridge.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the mountain is a cone from that point.
Okay.
So you can model a lot of stuff that way. That's probably, I'm not sure, I've probably given away a big trade secret there.
So you're saying so like
I'm working with that idea right now.
A mesa is actually just a bunch of stacked up cones that are cut off.
I would say the base of the mesa is.
Right.
And the top of the mesa itself is a big chunk of rock, and maybe you model that. You model the chunk of rock exactly how you want it to be, but then the base of the base of the mountain is a cone that extends out from that.
Interesting.
And that's because of the angle of repose that most materials have some kind of natural angle of repose, which is usually something between 35 and 40, maybe 20 degrees and 45 degrees, something like that. So you get these uniform looking slopes, and it's kind of a very defining feature of a lot of mountains.
And that's based on how much gravity we have on this planet.
Well, actually, the interesting thing is it's completely independent of gravity.
Really?
So that material would create the same slope on the moon as it does on...
Is it based... Why does the material...
It's based on... It's to do with the friction...
A friction rate.
Something.
But wouldn't the friction rate change with gravity?
So what happens is if you have the... If the gravity is 10 times as much, you have 10 times as much force pulling you downwards.
Down, yes.
But the more force you have coming down, the more it increases the friction.
Friction has... Oh.
So if you imagine these as a group of tiny little particles.
Yes.
There's going to be some angle at which one particle goes, oh, wait, I can roll over that one and fall to the next level.
Yes.
But if the slope is too shallow, that particle will never roll in any direction, no matter
right.
how big the gravity is, unless the gravity is so intense that it starts.
So you have that ultimate angle.
Yeah. And it's as a property of the material.
And that is less, it is, yeah.
Yeah.
So the friction rate actually has a bigger influence than the gravity rate.
Yeah. And then that can be influenced by all kinds of things like how much moisture there is and
sure.
You know, all kinds of other stuff.
Yeah, which affects the friction rate, which is ultimately what it's about.
Yep.
Awesome.
Mm.
Awesome. Well, I have learned a lot. I have learned a huge amount from you, and I'm fascinated by
it. And I think I've drank a lot as well.
Yeah, well, so have I. This is the point, man. Welcome yep. to the CG Garage. Matt, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this stuff and going through this.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I've known you for years and years, obviously. But I really want to sort of introduce people more hardcore in our world to the knowledge of the bigger environment, right? And not just thinking about the smaller ray tracing environment, but like thinking about rendering things that are 1,000 miles away or 1,000,000 miles away, right?
Yeah. And I think a lot of the time people think of that as being a separate problem. And when you actually simplify everything down into the fact that ultimately, it's seen by the same camera.
Right.
Distance is irrelevant.
Okay.
If something is 1,000,000 times further away, but it's 1,000,000 times larger, the math is the same.
Right. Yeah. But that is an important thing. So just thinking about that, but even just thinking about like how light scatters through the atmosphere or stuff like that, you know, when there is not going to be much, you know, refraction change between you and I that are mm-hmm. sitting 10 feet from each other, right? Through a normal air atmosphere.
Yep.
But if you were, you know, if I'm going to look at you through a telescope and see you 1,000,000 miles away, there's going to be some chromatic aberration of some kind.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? No matter how good a quality lens I use.
And I think sometimes people forget which things are existing in the lens and which things are existing outside of the lens.
Right.
And I think it's very important to separate those two things and know when you're adding that to your work,
sure.
know which of those things you're doing.
Right.
Chromatic aberration being a lens effect, a lot of bloom effect being a lens effect, but then in the distance you might have the sun creating a glow in the atmosphere.
Right.
Which is it's existing outside of the camera, and then that's a separate thing from lens flare. So.
Right. Oh, God. Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, very exciting, and I appreciate you doing this, especially timely with the Mars landing that happened recently, and just to be able to think about what that actually
yeah.
is about. And I know you're fascinated with Mars, so that's exciting. You must have been excited when that happened, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Melissa, who you met earlier, she's like a
okay.
huge, you know, star fan. So she bought NASA shoes yesterday. So
it's just because I've watched a bunch in the past, but yeah, I did watch the live. I watched the live landing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Really cool to see that and really interesting. And I think that people really need to think about what atmosphere means, in terms of their rendering. There's, you know, obviously they know about rendering through V-Ray, but I think that hearing what Matt has to offer in terms of the world of the general terrain and the atmosphere and clouds and how light interacts between all of those distances is something that's very needed in terms of the world of not just visual effects, but architecture, visualization, and all those things. So it's awesome to have that perspective on that. So thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been great.